Who's first? Yes, Dave.
How is it that Aristide didn't have any military force with which to resist the coup against him?
Aristide made a mistake, I think, and so do many of my comrades. In 1994, by allowing himself to be brought back to power in the saddle of a U.S. invasion. That's one I participated in, and that's what the book over there is about. Because Ben Dupuy, who's now the General Secretary of the National Popular Party, was Aristide's ambassador at large at the time, and he asked Aristide a question. He said, "Why has there never been a coup d'etat in Washington, D.C.?" And Aristide said, "I don't know." And Ben told him, "It's because there's no U.S. embassy there." He warned him, "Don't come back in there with the U.S. troops." But he did. He came back in with the U.S. troops, and they conducted an occupation that lasted, you know, it trickled down over a period of time, but about 2.5 years. And Aristide inherited a police/military force that was very politically unreliable because it had been constituted under the de facto regime of Raoul Seyd Ross and Michel Francois. Okay? So Aristide decided then that he didn't need an army. All he needed was a constabulary. And so he abolished the army and put in place a 6,000-man police force, a police force that was trained as police. They had, you know, Remington 870 shotguns and revolvers as sidearms. Not in any, and were in these little outposts with anywhere from 2 to 15 people. They couldn't withstand this attack that the paramilitaries brought one step at a time against them earlier this year, because these guys were showing up with RPGs and crew-served weapons. And I mean, you know, it's, you just think about 3 or 4 cops any place, and all of a sudden this trained military force comes after them and concentrates this incredible firepower on them. And so, yeah, they didn't have any way. And Aristide never intended to reconstitute an army, and that was, I think, an error. The same kind of coup d'etat was attempted against Hugo Chavez last year, and the armed forces at the end of the day were there, and they were loyal to their country. They were patriots that believed in the popular sovereignty of Venezuela, and they threw that coup d'etat back in the U.S.'s face. So, I mean, that's, again, you'll get me off on a tangent about this. But it is important to understand an Aristide, and his ascent to power was part of a long, painful, and complicated process that the United States set up the elections in 1989 after Baby Doc fled before one of these popular rebellions. Well, in 1994, when the U.S. came back to invade again, the fear wasn't of the de facto government. The fear was that a popular rebellion would install a revolutionary government, so they wanted to co-opt Aristide to come back in to put his face, a populist nationalist face, on a U.S. occupation. But prior to Aristide running, Aristide wasn't going to run. So the U.S., if people go do a web search on, and put it in quotes, National Endowment for Democracy. That sounds nice, don't it? And they've renamed the School of the Americans, I don't know, the Western Hemispheric Institute for Peace and Love or something now. but I mean, you know, we know what it is. Well, that the National Endowment for Democracy is the same thing, you know, it's a wolf in sheep's clothing. And what it does, it's no covert operations outfit that was set up by Ronald Reagan's administration to go out there and interfere in other people's elections. The kind of stuff that we would call illegal here, they do all over the place as a matter of policy. And Aristide was not a candidate. The U.S. wanted to run two candidates. Now, and it's real complicated about there's two ruling class factions, but the U.S. candidate was a World Bank guy named Mark Bazin. He's a technocrat. He's the perfect sort of colonial surrogate. But Mark Bazin was not very popular. So in order to make Mark Bazin popular, they went out and recruited this criminal from the Makut sector named Roger LaFontaine to be the opposition. Not because they wanted Roger LaFontaine to be in the election, because they wanted someone to make Mark Bazin look good. You see what I'm saying? So they had, you know, it was one of these, like our elections, where you got to do it. So, sorry. So, at the last minute, this small party that no one had ever heard of, the FNCD, went to this incredibly popular priest who'd been doing these local organizing initiatives all over the country for years through the Tea L'Église, the little church, because there's two Catholic churches in Haiti. There's the parish churches that tend toward liberation theology, and then there's the bishop's churches that always sort of like to snuggle up against the powerful, you know what I'm saying? And that struggle is going on too. But Aristide, you know, came out of nowhere at the last minute. He filed on the last day he was eligible to file. And the United States had no way at that point. Everything was in motion. They thought they had the fix on this thing. The people went to the polls and gave him 67% of the vote. And you know, the great Christ-like Jimmy Carter was one of the U.S. election observers that stalked out of the room in a rage because his candidate, Mark Bazin, wasn't the guy that won. Be careful about all these, you know, so-called human rights advocates around here. We started claiming human rights when we started dropping bombs on Yugoslavs and whatnot. You see what I'm saying? So, and that charter, we're, I was sitting there listening to that. We're in violation of every single one of those things. You know? There's only one country that's even competing with us for violating, and that's our big ally Israel over the Middle East right now. So, anyway, that's the way Aristide suddenly emerged on the scene, and it became a fait accompli, and then 8 months later they had to organize a coup. And it's not because there's big investment in Haiti. The infrastructure don't even work that. All the old assembly platform used to be Haiti made all the baseballs in the United States. You know, and they'd make women's brassieres and electronic, all this piecework stuff. They did that in Haiti, but now you can't even get the electricity to run all day in Port-au-Prince. So they've gone someplace else where they can get people to work cheaper, like, I don't know, Indonesia or someplace. But the reason to keep Haiti down, aside from, which is still important, continuing to point to Haiti as a failed state as proof of black incapacity for self-governance, the other reason they need that is because if Haiti gets away with it, everybody else in the region starts to get ideas, especially if Haiti gets away with it. You see what I'm saying? So hey, I'm off on a tangent now.
Liz.
For the Haitian people. Important to understand, again, going back to this ideological use of Haiti, that Haiti has to be kept down, not just because it's a colonized nation, because it's a black nation on our doorstep in a country that's still organized on the premises of white supremacy. The architect of the coup d'etat this year was a guy named Roger Noriega. Roger Noriega is a member of the whole clique that sort of grew out of the Iran-Contra thing, and that clique had grown out of the old Bay of Pigs veterans group. So these are all the same. In fact, if you take a picture of all the guys that did the Iran-Contra stuff and all the people who are in the State Department now, it's all the same guys. It's just one of these aging photos, you know? It's the same guy. You know, Roger Noriega, it's important to understand who Roger Noriega used to work for. He was an aide to a senator here in the United States. Anybody want to guess who he was? Jesse Helms. Jesse Helms, the most unrepentant racist in the whole U.S. Congress. I mean, there's plenty of racists in Congress, but there's none of them that go out there and whistle Dixie to Carol Moseley Braun in the elevator, you know what I mean? This is Jesse Helms' aide. So I think the timing of this coup d'etat was designed to be a special humiliation to the Haitian people on the bicentennial of their revolution. That's my opinion.
Mr. Goff, do you want to comment on your court martial when you went into Haiti in 1994?
That's a long, painful story right there.
A little bit of background.
Okay, yeah, well, I was a member of 3rd Special Forces at the time. I still wear my Special Forces pin over here. It's not because I'm like all into militarism, but right here on the bottom of it, it's got the motto. This is a Special Forces motto, the United States Special Forces motto, covert operations motto, De Oppresso Liber, to liberate the oppressed. Ironic.
Ironic.
So, me and my perennial naivete after having gone to 7 other conflict areas and feeling ashamed of myself for what we were involved in every one of them, didn't understand the structure that I understand now. And that's why we should study. Seeing it and knowing it's wrong is not the same as understanding why and how it's wrong. See what I'm saying? But I didn't understand it then, and I thought, just once, maybe I'm going to be involved in something that's a right thing to do. It didn't take me long after I got down there to figure out that wasn't a program. But at that point, I had started to become kind of rebellious, and I was in a situation with 8 people, and I was basically the de facto military dictator of 1,000 square kilometers in northeastern Haiti. And I had this incredible autonomy for the first couple months because the task force command in Port-au-Prince was so completely disorganized. And so I was basically doing whatever I wanted to do. So, it actually was kind of fun for a while. I arrested the guy that's running Go Naive right now, Jean Tatu, and I put him in jail. I put Neil Calixte in jail. He was a former ambassador to France under Francois Duvalier. Right. I put René Mozart, the Northeast Department's president of FROP, in jail. I put 10 other people in jail. So it was like the FROP had shot a couple Special Forces guys, and for a little while we had a window because our commander was mad. He said, go get them. And so I started throwing people in jail, people who had used to throw everybody else in jail, which was sort of interesting to watch because it was amazing how humble they got when the door closed. And we give them an MRE to eat. But I also began to go out and do what I'd been trained to do in Special Forces for a different reason, and that was to build rapport with the local population. And building rapport with the local population, the vast majority of them meant building rapport with the committees of La Valas. And so I made alliances with members of La Valas and failed to read between the lines of the mission guidance that was coming from the task force commanders, and made the other mistake of saying around members of my own team that in 24 years of military service, I'd never seen a single intelligence summary that was accurate. The intelligence summaries that we were getting were just grotesque anti-Aristide vitriol that had no relevance in terms of situation on the ground. And I became vocal about that. And I became a little bit unstable. And I got away with it for 3 months. And the word trickled back. And members of my own team went in and turned me in for being seditious. And one day they came out in a Humvee and picked me up and drove me away. Now, long story short, I got shipped back to Fort Bragg and was taken into the Sergeant Major's office when I got back. And he said, Master Sergeant Officer, it looks like we're going to have to consider a general court-martial. And I was, right on the verge of my retirement. I'd been working for I had over 20 years of active duty in and was entitled to a check that I'd worked pretty hard for. And that ain't talking about I'm entitled to a check, because I was in the military. You take a job and work for retirement, you want your retirement when you get done, So I said, I'm fighting for my life here. And if we're going to go do a court-martial, then we're going to mud wrestle. And I sit there and gave him a list of all the violations I'd seen, not only of General Order 1, which I was accused of violating, but of attempted rapes that have been covered up, shootings that have been covered up, all kinds of malfeasance that went all the way up to the level of 06 colonels. And the next day he called me in. I wasn't Master Sergeant Goff, I was Stan. Now he said, come on in, Stan. Like everything changed, yeah. He says, we think you should go ahead and submit your retirement paperwork. I said, I think so too. So that was that.
I'm an equal. Since Cuba plays the same role basically that Haiti doing right after the independence of Haiti, it being an inspiration to other struggling people in Latin America and throughout the world, comment on the relationship between Haiti, Cuba, and Venezuela, since the Cubans have done a lot of good work in Haiti. We're sending doctors, medical personnel, teachers. They've even built a school there, which the U.S., I understand now, the U.S. is using as a military base. They closed the school down.
Yeah, I'd love to comment on that. Cuba is poor because there's been this embargo. I mean, you know, a lot of stuff just can't go in there. And as poor as they are in Cuba, unlike Newark, there's one physician for every 200 people that live there. That's a pretty good deal. Yeah, you go to Haiti, there's one physician for every 5,000 people that live there. And the only place that people can go to get medical help right now are one of the 400 Cuban medical clinics that are all over Haiti right now. Onesies and twosies everywhere, and they're doing the best they can, and they don't have drugs, but it's the only medical care that's available. It's interesting, you know, that we send troops in uniforms over to other countries as a manifestation of our foreign policy, and Cuba sends doctors, nurses, and teachers. There's a lot of stuff we could learn from Cuba. You know, and maybe people wouldn't be blowing us up with IEDs if we sent some doctors and nurses over there, you know, but that's a long story. Cuba and Venezuela already have a relationship. Haiti is, because there's no one, and this is a diplomatic issue, there's no one to relate to as a chief of state right now. So, you know, who does Fidel Castro relate to in Haiti right now? Gerard Latortue? I mean, they don't even recognize him. CARICOM won't even recognize it as a legitimate government. God bless CARICOM, you know. And it's not because CARICOM don't have its share of compradors and opportunists, but CARICOM is a bunch of other little black countries around there that are saying, damn, they can do that to them, they can do the same thing to us. You know what I mean? So it's been a reality check for a lot of folks up there. But Venezuela's in a unique situation. Venezuela not only got away with throwing a coup d'etat back in the U.S.'s face, but we import 14% of our net oil from Venezuela. So Venezuela kind of got us by the short hair. And it's true. And they haven't tried to take that away. So they've got an element of economic and resource dependency that's built into that. They've got a loyal armed force, and they've got a mobilized population. These Bolivarian circles are the neatest thing since sliced bread. And you know, they talk about them like the armed gangs. These weren't armed gangs. Anybody ever seen that documentary film, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised? You got to say, oh, if you don't weep at the end of 70 minutes of watching that film, then you ain't human. It's inspiring. As a soldier who went all over the world and had people fear me, when I see those soldiers fuse with the masses like they did in Venezuela, it's incredible. That's the way it ought to be, y'all. That's the way it's supposed to be. You see, man, I must have latent preacher tendencies. But Venezuela is supplying Cuba with petroleum, which takes a lot of pressure off of it otherwise. And Venezuela will probably offer Haiti petroleum once they get something that looks like a legitimate government in there. Because all three of these countries have been demonized. You can read the majority of the American press, and all you get is stuff that looks like a communique from the State Department. You know? And there's a reason for that. When I was in El Salvador in 1985, I went out on a date with someone from the Chicago Tribune. And she'd been there for a long time. And I asked her, because she was telling me, she said, man, I know about all these human rights violations up in San Miguel province. I said, why don't you write about them? She said, if I wrote about that, then I would lose access to all my official contacts in the U.S. Embassy. It's not like a conspiracy. You know, it's a system. We're just all integrated into it and looking out for ourselves. But we're looking out for ourselves in a structure that we don't have any control over. And it still works that way. It still works that way. Now, some of these things, like Fox, man. Fox, I believe, works directly for DOD. And I'm not sure about CNN sometimes. You know, but when you read this stuff that they're writing, or you see the stuff that they're saying, Chavez is a dictator, which is preposterous. In my opinion, it's preposterous to say that Fidel Castro is a dictator, because I've watched the way that the masses relate to Fidel Castro, you know. They want to talk, well, he's got some political prisoners. They're throwing stones at them for having 27 political prisoners. We got 2 million human beings incarcerated in the United States. They're going to throw stones at China for human rights violations. China's got 1.5 million people in prison. China's got 5 times our population. And they got 3/4 the number of people in prison that we do. And we're going to sit around and start, you know, wagging fingers at China about the human rights problem, you know? So, I mean, again, get me off on a tangent here.
Let me get another question.
Sorry.
Down. Graham. Don't sit down.
The format that was presented tonight wanted to connect the dots in pertaining to with the Haitian children, particularly in the local areas. For example, Irvington High School, there's a problem there that has existed with the Haitian children and also the African American children to the level of violence. And with the information that you presented this evening, can you, in your travels, possibly formulate something that would help educate these children to help, you know, quell this violence? Because this is a violence that's going on and they are in the diaspora. And I think lack of knowledge is fueling this continual violence in this school.
I live in Raleigh, North Carolina. I have put 3 black children through the public school system myself. My family is diverse, confusingly diverse at times. And I'm familiar with that, the problems that we've had, and it depends, too, on the level of funding in schools. There's some schools, like in eastern North Carolina, so debilitated that they function more as like a zookeeping operation than they do as a school now. But in even in some of the schools that have funding, we're seeing that these are the issues that we see around education. Suspension policies that are unequally, shall we say, carried out against black children. Standardized testing issues that are huge right now, and they're making these things more and more punitive. Tracking issues, because see, we got 4 tracks. I forget the like official names for the 4 tracks, but you know the names for them that I've got is you've got the college track, you've got like the mechanic track, and then you've got like the poultry factory track, and then you've got the penitentiary track, and they don't get put into these tracks in high school. They put them in these tracks in 1st, 2nd, and 3rd grade, you know. So, I mean, that's the education issues that we see people struggling around there. And a local group called PACE, that's all they work on. I just wasn't sure about bringing, you know, like local issues from the Triangle in North Carolina into here. And I'm not familiar with the specifics.
All right.
How can justice, social, and peace activists help the situation in Haiti?
I'm glad you asked that question.
All right.
Right now, what they need is cash flow. You know, what we need right now is we need 300, 400, 500, 600 individuals to give $5 a month and send it to the Haiti Support Network, care of Haiti Progress, the same website address that I gave earlier. It's at 1398 Flatbush down in Brooklyn. I don't remember the zip code, but use that address, Haiti Support Network. We need people that will commit to send $1, $2, $5 a month and keep it going, because what happens is if that money comes in and establishes a cash flow, the stuff that Haiti Progress is doing and that the PPN is doing right now in terms of trying to communicate with the public, those funds are in competition with stuff that goes out there and does the actual resistance work. So every penny that we free up for the network, or it's actually the PPN, for the PPN and their newspaper, IT Progray, that's a penny that then can get diverted directly into the organizing for the resistance out in the countryside. I mean, it's just straight up. That's what they need. These communities of people that are up there like Maroons right now, I think right now probably about $3,000 a month. And there's quite a few people up there. It's costing about $3 to $3.50 a day for each person, because these people are fleeing from certain death in their homes. They'll be targeted and killed. But when we get them out to the countryside there, they take a machete, I've never seen people be able to do it. They can take a machete and peel an orange and build a house. I mean, they can take a machete and do anything with a machete. Okay? All they need is some food. And when you get up in the mountains at a certain elevation, the only thing that grows up there is like coffee, banana, beans. They have to buy their rice, they have to buy their flour. So buying the rice, buying the flour, buying a little bit of meat to keep the dietary protein up, about $3-$3.50 a day. So that's, you know, that's what we're looking at right now. So we just need to get some cash flow going in there from lots and lots of different people here, and everything that we do ends up in one way or another translating into more support for these folks, because they're going to be the core of any kind of a movement that comes out of the countryside.
So what about the programs that the Red Cross and the UN and other organizations were setting up?
Be very afraid of NGOs. Most of them work hand in glove with the United States Agency for International Development, and I hate to disabuse anyone of yet one more illusion, but USAID is not an aid agency. They work for the embassy. Okay? They set up all these little micro programs that look on a case-by-case basis like they're doing something good, but what they're really doing is giving a couple of people, subtracting them from the popular movements at home, giving them little jobs, getting them paid, and concentrating them on project by project, and stripping off the local intelligentsia so they can't be involved in revolutionary work, and they're out there spying. Because everything that they do gets reported back to this embassy. The embassy, it goes into something called the political section, which is a euphemism for Central Intelligence Agency. Mm. And then they in turn go around and communicate with their counterparts, with the military attaché, the economic attaché that, you know, talks to the national chain. You know, it's all a deal. So be very afraid. They're not all like that, but look very closely before you give your money to charity organizations overseas.
Yes, yes.
Some of them are just missionaries out there trying to do, you know, like a little program. And some of the missionary programs I have an issue with too, because they're out there calling local people's religions devil worship and stuff
Thank you.
Thank you. You know, in fact, voodoo, if anybody doesn't know, is one of the most gentle, accepting, and decent religions in the world.
That's right.
I hope y'all can open up a chapter in Raleigh. This is really a great group, and thanks for having me.